Welcome to Follow the Sound. I am your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we bring you different aspects of the world of music, including album reviews, concert reviews, and this week in music history, which is what we are bringing you this week right now. Of course, if you would like to help us out on this podcast, you can go to our website at followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that Amazon banner on the right-hand side, and that'll take you to Amazon. Do all of your normal shopping, and it will not cost you anything extra. But we get a little bit of money back for every purchase that you make. So go to the website, followthesoundpodcast.com, click on that banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And along with me to help me out with this show today is the very talented Jacob Crum.
Children behave. That's what they say when we're together.
Do they? I guess so. Either way, Jake, how you doing?
Good enough.
Good enough. That's good to hear. So, yes, we don't have our third person with us tonight. Greg is out. We expect him back in the future at some point in time, whenever he gets around to it. It's perfectly fine with us. But, yes, Jake and I are going to take the show tonight and give you some nice music history going from January 22nd through January 26th, because that's what we do. We do weekdays, because that's what our work week is, and that's what we want to listen to. So let's go ahead and actually get this sucker rolling with January 22nd, which would be a Monday for us right now. And starting out 1959, Buddy Holly makes his last recordings alone with an acoustic guitar in his Greenwich Village apartment. The songs include Peggy Sue Got Married, Crying, Waiting, Hoping, That's What They Say, What to Do, Learning the Game, and That Makes It Tough. The rough versions are overdubbed and released after his death. That's fascinating, though. I mean, I know that... Buddy Holly has always been one of those guys to me that, you know, had he lived, I bet he would have produced some really amazing music. Like, it would have been really nice to see how he evolved going into, like, the latter part of the 60s and stuff, like, as an artist. But I don't know. It's one of those things that we'll never know.
Yeah. It's crazy to think that Peggy Sue was released posthumously.
Well, that was Peggy Sue Got Married.
Those are two different songs.
Yeah.
Oh, well, all right. It's like Peggy Sue Part 2?
Yeah, basically.
Ah.
Yeah, so at least I'm like 90% sure that's the case. I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that it was two separate songs, because it was Peggy Sue and then Peggy Sue Got Married. Yeah. Yep, Peggy Sue Got Married. Completely two different things. Also, a movie. Starring Kathleen Turner. Thanks, Google.
Oh, well, I see. I was gonna put that up there with Hank Williams' "Your Cheating Heart" as like the most influential posthumous release. Or
well, it's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Otis.
Yes.
Otis Redding.
Yes, Otis Redding.
I was
letting you get to it.
I know.
I knew what it was.
I know.
I was just letting you get to it.
Because I couldn't let my mouth say what my brain was thinking,
yes,
which was
yes.
Billy Ocean.
Oh, nice.
Dock of the Bay, Otis Ocean. I don't know.
I mean, that is, of course, until, you know, the many posthumous Prince albums get released.
Oh, yeah, you know.
You know, because we all know that he had secret albums in a vault.
That is true.
And his family just needs to, like, release those. And then we'll have tons of Prince music going forward.
I think we have enough already.
We could use
more. I would say we have too much already.
He did, like, 40 albums or something, so.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
We could do with a few less bat dances.
That's true.
That's all I'm saying.
All right, so what's the next one we got, Jake?
1985. In his annual worst dressed list, fashion critic Mr. Blackwell names Cher as the worst of 1984, writing that she has, quote, little or less respect for being a woman. Pretty harsh words. I put this in just because I remember this being a thing.
Really?
Yeah, this was like on every morning show. They were talking about who comes in with the worst dress list this year.
Yeah, but you were three.
Okay.
Maybe it's like one of those residual memories where everybody kept talking about it.
Yeah.
Like years afterwards, you're like, you remember when he said this about Cher?
That's possible.
So
that is possible.
I run into that problem a lot because my dad told me a lot of stories, and then it's like, wait, did I actually remember this, or is it just something that my dad told me? So
yeah. However, there was a tie for number 10,
which was
Prince, who was described as a toothpick wrapped in a purple dolly. Excuse me, purple doily.
Doily. Oh, nice.
Yes. And Dee Snider, who was described as a car crash in a whorehouse.
As he would probably have loved to be described as.
I would myself, too.
So I like that. It's pretty good. So, yeah. Yeah, I like that. You know, I mean, of course, Cher had her serious mishaps when it came to fashion. But her fashion style from that time period is still being mimicked to this day by thousands of drag queens. So that's perfectly fine, I guess. But
Ryan and I are simpatico in our support for the drag queen community. I mean, we both love drag queens. They're punk rock as hell. And anything subversive.
Honestly,
support.
In my entire life, I've only met one drag queen. So, yeah, a local drag queen here in St. Louis that I met one time, and that was it. That was the only drag queen I've ever come across.
Oh, you weren't there for the vampires?
No.
Oh man. Okay, so the first Last Impossible show that I went to.
Okay.
All right. We arrive in Austin, Texas. I had never been to Austin at that point.
Good town.
Yeah. And they're playing at Emo's.
Yes.
You know, good venue. Very
yes,
nice
yes.
club. At the time.
Because they released that concert on DVD.
Yes.
And I've seen it many times.
Yeah. It was a really good show. However, right next to Emo's at that time, there was another venue that I'm sure it had a name, but it didn't have a name on the building.
Yeah.
The building was just painted flat black. Which made me think, oh, it's like the Galaxy, right?
Oh, nice, yeah.
Except that it was a really weird venue, because at 11 o'clock in the morning, we were met with two vampire drag queens.
Ooh.
Yeah. Which was like, you know, I was like, what, 19 at the time?
Something like that, yeah.
And it's like 11 o'clock in the morning, and these people are walking around with fangs in their mouth just smiling at people. Like, dude, Austin is on another level. This city is amazing.
Nice. Austin is a very strange town. So that being said, their food scene is on point. Like, mm-hmm. They got some amazing food down there.
What time do you wake up to, like, get that put together to be out on the street at 11 o'clock?
Oh, they were probably still up from the previous night.
Okay, there you go.
You know, I know a ton of people that do that kind of crap, but
yeah.
Yeah, I never,
yeah, fair
I never
enough.
Did that, but yes, but let's get on to our birthdays for January 22nd, and this one, we're starting off with one of my favorite singers, the one and only Sam Cooke, and I believe I got a little something for you. The one and only Sam Cooke. That is one of my all-time favorite songs.
Yeah.
All-time favorites.
I think that was on his first release, wasn't it?
I don't think so. I think that was released a little bit later on. But Sam Cooke got his start in gospel music and worked his way up through different different, you know, solo projects or whatever, until finally striking it big, doing a, you know, like the usual stuff back then. He did a bunch of covers and stuff from other songs, but then he started releasing this kind of music and people just loved it.
What is it about gospel singers that produce young men that sound like old men?
I don't know.
Because, I mean, like, okay, so, you know, Sam Cooke sounds like he's 65 when he was 29.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a John certain Fogarty, quality. Yeah.
That's another gospel guy that sounded like an old man when he was a young man.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
But yeah, Sam Cooke, of course, born in Clarksdale, Mississippi, but he grew up in Chicago, where at 6 years old, he formed a group, the Singing Children, with his siblings. And he later on went to do more of the gospel-y stuff and work his way up from there. But I love that song, Bring It On Home. That's still one of my all-time favorites. But also, his version of Old Man River, it just blows me away every time I hear it. I love that version of it because it's a little bit swingy and it's like a little bit more upbeat. But he just hits all these points. Sam Cooke's voice, though, is just so good. And he's got this certain just essence to it that I love. So, happy birthday, Sam Cooke. But moving on to somebody else whose voice that I really love.
Don't make me do this.
Loved, at least, because he can't really sing like that anymore. And that is, in 1949, Steve Perry was born in Hanford, California. Of course, Steve Perry being the most prominent frontman for Journey. Not the only frontman for Journey, right, but definitely the most famous frontman for Journey. And he dropped out of the band and did a couple of solo things, and he now occasionally sings at like different places. But he doesn't do a lot of the same. He couldn't go up in front Journey today. He just can't. His voice isn't there anymore.
Oh yeah,
yeah, it's just not there. It happens sometimes, you know. Age comes on and you just lose it, especially when you had like singing super loud and powerfully like he did. So. But now Journey is, of course, fronted by Arnel Pineda, the famous Filipino.
Who sounds just like Steve Perry.
Who sounds just like Steve Perry. And if you didn't hear, Journey and Def Leppard are going on tour together, and they are playing in St. Louis at Busch Stadium.
Which is very convenient for me.
Yes.
Because rather than having to avoid two concerts, I only have to avoid one.
I'm actually looking forward to going.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Because I've seen Journey twice now in concert. At the amphitheater, but I have never seen Def Leppard.
Yeah.
And I'd like to see them at least once. So.
How, like, familiar are you with Journey's music?
Pretty, I know like all the hits.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because, like, the story from the old guys in the music shop all the time is like, never buy an album that has Steve Perry on it. You gotta get their early stuff, because early Journey was really good.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know if you know, the band was, like, made up of members of two other failed bands.
Yes.
Which was Santana and Grumpy Bandersnatch or something. Bandersnatch, right? I forget what, but, so, yeah, they were, like a psychedelic kind of wannabe. I've never been impressed with any of it. Like every time I've talked to an old music shop guy who's like, "Oh no, you gotta listen to this early stuff." It's just kind of disjointed and not put together very well.
Frumious Bandersnatch.
Frumious Band, yeah, there you go.
Because that's a name. But yeah, they started in 1973.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, no, I mean, of course they didn't make it famous until after Steve Perry had been in the group and then, you know, shot them up into superstardom like that. You know, so I always liked Journey. I know you were not a huge fan of theirs.
Yeah, I know. It's not that they're not, there's, okay, so Steve Perry can sing. He's a talented guy.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not like the musicianship is poor. I just have never appreciated the execution of anything that they've done.
Mm.
And listening to Don't Stop Believing makes me want to pull my ears out and destroy them. I can't stand that song. The lyrics are nonsensical and they're dumb. The melody isn't even particularly infectious. I don't understand why everyone loves that song.
Because it's got a happy chord progression.
I guess.
It's true. It's the same chord progression that's used in 1,000 other songs. And so everybody likes it.
And then don't get me started on When the Lights Go Down in the City.
Yeah.
Because every time that song comes on at a bar, everyone sings along to it. Nobody knows the words.
Well, I know the words.
I don't care that you don't go to bars, Brian.
That's true.
All right, so
I know you go to karaoke sometimes, and one of these days I'll go out with you. But and just for you, I'll do When the Lights Go Down in the City.
No, you will not, dude. I'll smash the equipment and get arrested.
Actually, you know what I would do?
Yeah,
I would do The Chain by Fleetwood Mac.
Ooh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That's another one of those bands that everybody's like, well, if you listen to the early stuff of Fleetwood Mac, then, you know, that's when they were really a great band. I was like, oh, as opposed to later on when they had one of the highest selling albums of all time, became multi-Grammy award winning artist, and featured some of the best musicians to ever come out of rock and roll. That, you don't like that band? That's good. That's good that you don't like that band. It's like, stop it with your BS about this band was better back when they were unknown. It's like, bull. Sometimes bands get better when they replace people, and Fleetwood Mac is one of those bands.
I think the two of us should do a classic duet.
Oh yeah?
Yes.
Endless Love?
Sure. Hey, I can pull off Lionel Richie.
Yeah, but then that makes me do the girl part.
Well, okay, then that's how that is.
Go ahead and do the last birthday of the day, Jake.
Here we go. 1965. None other than Jeff, who? DJ Jazzy Jeff, that's who.
Yeah.
Is born as Jeffrey Allen Towns in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
In West Philadelphia.
Word.
So, yeah. No, of course, Jazzy Jeff has gone on to do other things. He's, you know, been consistently working as a producer and working with other artists and stuff like that, but definitely most famous. And he's still, like, if Will Smith is doing something musically speaking, he teams up with Jeff in some way, shape, or form. But
when was the last time that happened, though?
Well, I mean, Will Smith doesn't like tour or anything. He'll just make an album randomly in a decade and then drop it and then shoot to number one with 10 different hit singles.
When was the last time that happened? On multiple charts.
It's been a while.
I mean, like,
he's been really focused on acting, and so, but
he's been focused on getting his kids gigs.
That's true. He has been getting his kids acting gigs. But then again, I mean, they did have,
one of his sons has an album, right?
His daughter and son.
Okay.
Let's see, what was it? It was the Get Down
on
Netflix that had the recent
good show.
Smith, Jaden Smith as Dizzy. And actually, that was the best that I think he's ever acted in a show or movie.
Wait, you're saying that you didn't like the remake of The Karate Kid?
No. You mean The Kung Fu Kid?
I don't know.
Because they learn kung fu, not karate?
That's true. They should have changed the title. I might have seen that.
Yeah. Or, you know, that other After Earth or whatever thing that he did. Or whatever it was where they crash land on Earth and he's got to, go to this thing to rescue his dad and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, Jaden Smith is one of those actors that's just like, really, dude? Like, you need to, get better at this. You need to get better faster. But then again, he did the thing on The Get Down, and I thought he played a really good sort of whimsical character. And I was like, well, maybe that's just what he needs to be. He can't be a true serious actor. He needs to be more of a creative, artistic actor, which, you know, whatever. But, yeah, we got onto the wrong Smith there. Either way, happy birthday, DJ Jazzy Jeff. So... He's done a lot of good stuff in his career, and I'm happy, and I'm glad he's...
I also just love hearing his name pop up in stories.
That is true, because you got to say DJ Jazzy Jeff. You can't just say Jazzy Jeff or Jeff. But yeah, you gotta say DJ Jazzy Jeff, which a lot of J's.
Either way, we've got day number two coming up. Yes. January 23rd.
Yeah, you want to take this one?
I do. Go 1988, at age 16, Tiffany becomes the youngest female singer with a number one album in the U.S. when her self-titled debut tops the chart.
Yes.
So, if...
I forgot the name of that song, though.
I Think We're Alone Now.
Oh, is that what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Well, no, this is album, not single.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, previously... The young lady who did Leader of the Pack was the youngest.
Yeah.
Right. There had been a couple of other singles in the 50s with, like, you know.
Yeah, I thought it was the one from the Ronettes that had, like, mm-hmm. Who is the had like the youngest number one single or yes. something like that. But yeah.
So we're talking albums now, and so that was 1988, and then that was eclipsed in 1997 when a 14-year-old Leanne Rimes scored a number one hit or number one album with a compilation album, which was on Chen Melody. And then in 2007, that was taken over by Miley Cyrus at
14 years.
Yes, 14 years and 7 months, just slightly younger than Leanne Rimes was at the time, with Hannah Montana 2.
Yes.
Which was titled Hannah Montana 2 Meet Miley Cyrus. Anyway, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, yeah.
There you go.
Got it.
So remember when that happened. However, still the youngest person with the number one album is Stevie Wonder.
Of course. Right. The genius.
The genius. Stevie Wonder, who had a number one hit, instrumental hit, which was like the only number one instrumental for a good 30-something years.
Yeah.
With Fingertips, and the album that came off of, it was originally released just as a single, and then later put on an LP, which was called Recorded Live, The 12-Year-Old Genius.
Yes.
However, it wasn't released until he was 13, so 13 is the youngest
yeah.
for a number one album in the U.S. sales.
So, weirdly enough, I love how that sort of all played out. But to close it out, I guess, with a little bit of Stevie Wonder, whenever he was up in Detroit, like working with the Funk Brothers, he would play an instrument. And then he would hear other people playing instruments, mm-hmm. and he would go, "Hey, how do you play that?" And they would show him how to play it, you know, and do some stuff on there. They said he'd come back next week and be able to play your instrument better than you. Because that's what he did. And, like, I know a lot of people, it's like, oh, Stevie Wonder, you know, he's a really good singer, he's a good keyboard player, and he's blind. Yeah, it's like, no, the dude seriously was a music genius, or is a music genius. Like, he sits down and he figures out instruments, like, at the drop of a hat. I mean, honestly, he's probably, musically speaking, on the level of someone like Mozart. Like, you know, with the ability to compose music and create it and, like, just focus it into something that you can hear. It's like, he's really, really good at this. So
I love him when he plays harmonica.
Yeah, I always like that, too.
He plays, you know, chromatic style, and he's one of the few, like, chromatic harmonica players that can do a really bluesy tone on what is a really precise
mm-hmm.
sort of... orchestral instrument.
Like, yes.
He makes it really sexy.
Yeah.
When he plays that. Not a lot of people do.
The thing that I always liked about Stevie Wonder is that the way that he sang, he would move his head and his mouth in a particular way that may not look aesthetically pleasing, but it sounds really cool. And the reason why is because he couldn't see what he looked like while doing it. And so he didn't know that he would do something that would look kind of mm-hmm. strange to other people. And it's just funny to me how like, you know, not having eyesight could affect his music so much like that, because he didn't learn those affectations from other people that he saw singing because he didn't know what they were doing in the first yeah. place. I was like, that's just great. It's like, take away one thing and he just goes off in a completely different direction to figure something out. So he's like, oh, how do I make this sound? Well, I, you know, move my head in a particular way and I shape my mouth to do this. The only other person who I've seen really do something like that is John Mayer. and John Mayer can see. And so I was like, I don't even know how he picked that one up, but he did. So there you go.
Oh, piggyback off this real quick.
Yeah, so, go ahead.
Leanne Rimes, Miley Cyrus also have something else in common.
Besides being country artists?
They both have two number one albums before they were 18.
Oh, nice.
There's one more person that does.
Who? Stevie Wonder?
No. No. Justin Bieber.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because he started pretty young with his whole thing, and he had that first hit single, Baby, and went on from there. So, yeah. It's understandable. I get that. But, yeah. Let's go ahead and move on to our birthdays, though. Would you like to do this one, Jake?
Sure. Because I love me some of this guy. 1910, jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt is born in Belgium.
There you go, Django Reinhardt.
Love that guy.
Yes, fascinating. He's one of these dudes that I've been hearing like my whole life, but I've never like thoroughly researched. So like, but what are they called him the three fingered something. I forgot what it was. I'm gonna have to look this one up. Do you have anything to say about Django Reinhardt while I look this up?
I sure do. Django Reinhardt was the cornerstone of non-American jazz. He was really kind of the first person outside of the U.S., you know, because jazz is an American invention. It's one of the two only important art forms that have ever come out of the U.S., like original, which is jazz and stand-up comedy. And Django was the first guy to really kind of pick it up and eat it and speak jazz. And he started a real jazz culture in France and Belgium, and Europe was the richer for it.
Yeah. I like that. I'm just looking at some of it. Obviously, the song that we just listened to was Minor Swing, for any of those who don't know, which is one of his most popular songs. What they actually called it was gypsy jazz, which makes sense, because if you listen to that style of play, like it kind of has that sort of underlying gypsy guitar style. But yeah, he I don't know. He's one of these dudes that like you just hear about all the time. He was a major influencer on a bunch of other guitar players. I mean, in not just jazz, but in rock as well. And you know, he's Django Reinhardt. Like, go look him up. Like, not hard to do. Search on YouTube. You can find his entire albums of his, entire like live concerts that he put on, and a bunch of live footage of him playing songs. And it's great because he looks so relaxed while playing too. Because he's just like, but he's like sitting there, you know, like smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I love Max Roach so much.
Oh yeah,
because he's just so laid back and just chill, like when he's drumming. Like the only thing that's moving is his fingers. The rest of him is just statuesque.
See, but I always liked Buddy Rich. Buddy Rich was always my favorite. That's just because, it's Buddy Rich. But.
Well, fair enough.
But yes, let's...
Buddy Rich, end of argument.
Yeah. Well, that is true. But let's go ahead and move on up to 1938 on January 23rd. Eugene Church, lead singer of The Fellows, is born in St. Louis, Missouri. Known for the 1958 R&B hit Pretty Girls Everywhere. Yeah.
So about a month ago, we did a story on Dwayne Cochran.
Yeah.
Dwayne Cochran and CeCe Riders. And I believe the song that we played, no, it wasn't Miami. I think the song I want to say the song we played.
I want to say
Miami.
It was Miami.
Or it might have been Harlem Shuffle. I think it was Miami. Anyway, That is a version of a Union Church song.
Oh, okay, nice.
Very different from the original composition, because like Eugene's version is very bluesy.
Yes, yes.
But it's the same song.
So, let's go ahead and move on to January 24th and starting off with a great one here. Not necessarily music-oriented, but still very important to the world of sound in general. And that is, in 1961, Mel Blanc, who, if you don't know who Mel Blanc is, shame on you. How dare you not know who Mel Blanc is? But he was the voice of Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, and many other cartoon favorites. Here, I'm going to play you a slight sample of Mel Blanc doing voices.
Let's run through that again.
Okay. Would you like to shoot me now or wait till you get home?
Shoot him now. Shoot him now.
You keep out of this. He doesn't have to shoot you now.
Ha! That's it. Hold it right there.
Pronoun trouble.
It's not he doesn't have to shoot you now. It's he doesn't have to shoot me now.
Well, I say he does have to shoot me now! So shoot me now!
Sorry. It's so good.
So which one was he?
He was both of those. He was both Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny. And he did a ton of other voices throughout. I mean, he was Sylvester. He was the Foghorn Leghorn. He was, Barney Rubble. I mean, like, he was all over the place. A man of 1,000 voices. And he could just do everything in, like, inside of those. It just, Mel Blanc was, of course, really, really great. But that is not why he is on our list today. The reason why he is on our list was that he got into a horrible car accident on this date in 1961 on a stretch of road in Los Angeles known as the Dead Man's Curve. Hearing the news, Roger Christian is inspired to write a song about that treacherous turn.
Recorded by Jan and Dean.
Yep, which was Dead Man's Curve.
Dead Man's Curve,
yeah. Yep. So there you go. Mel Blanc gets into an accident and inspires a song. So
this moment actually is kind of a big chapter in Mel Blanc's life, that car accident.
Yes.
Because he was laid up in the hospital in traction for a very long time,
mm-hmm.
and was on morphine. And had his producer not been a complete sociopath, Mel Blanc has said himself that he probably would have become a homeless drug addict and died much earlier. Because he was addicted to morphine. However, because their producer for Looney Tunes at the time was a sociopath, he convinced Mel that he needed to keep recording audio so that the company wouldn't go under. So they did. They got enough, quote, portable equipment for the time. So, you know, like a 200-pound tube amplifier, and set up a recording studio in the hospital, paid to do it.
Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah.
There you go. And that's when Mel Blanc said at that point, that was when people started, or the writers for Looney Tunes, started asking him to do other things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the rule became, if you didn't know what to do, just go to Mel.
Yeah.
Right. So they would write little, just like suggestions in there, like Mel Blanc makes the sound of a fish, rather than trying to ask a Foley artist to do it.
Yeah. It was kind of amazing because I remember some stuff that they did with him where they would ask him to like come up with a character voice,
mm-hmm.
right? And they would be like, okay, we want like a little bit of this and a little bit of this, and we want a little bit of this other character, but we want it to be Scottish. And then he would bust it out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just like that. And not only could he do that voice just like that, but he could do everything. Because if they needed him to sing a song like that character,
yeah.
he could sing a song like that character. And it was just so, so amazing. And he could, like, remember all this stuff, too. He could do Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck at the drop of a hat. Like, he didn't have to practice. He didn't have to, like, listen back to his character. He just knew exactly what to do that voice. And I just, man, was a complete and total brilliant, human being. So, at least when it came to voice acting.
Yes.
He set the standard for everyone else in, who came later on in the business. And even now, today, like some of my favorite voice actors, they will all say that they got their start because of Mel Blanc. So, there you go.
Yeah, that singing in character thing is a whole nother, it's a whole nother layer too.
Yes. There was a great documentary that I saw on Netflix that was about that. I think it was called, I Know That Voice or something like that. And it was put on by the guy who does the voice of Bender.
Okay.
Yeah. From Futurama. And he goes around to all the different people, like the famous voice actors, and interviews them and talks about how they got their start, you know, what they're doing and, you know, like that kind of stuff. And I loved how he just sort of got everybody together because they're all his friends.
Yeah.
But if you want to see one of the greatest sort of tributes to a person like Mel Blanc, go on YouTube and find videos of these voice actors doing panels at like Comic-Con and stuff where they read movie scripts as characters. And I tell you this, I saw one that had all of these great guys, including the guy who does all the voices for like a bunch of the Winnie the Pooh characters.
Mm-hmm.
You have not laughed your head off until you have heard Winnie the Pooh as Darth Vader. It was single-handedly one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. I could not breathe. So there you go. But once again, all those people pay homage to Mel Blanc, and there's a big section in that documentary about Mel Blanc. So,
I think I'd rather hear Christopher Robbins do lines from.
But I mean, they've done other stuff. They've done like Pulp Fiction, like as characters, cartoon characters. You want to destroy your childhood? That's the way to do it, right there. But let's go ahead and move on to our next story of the day.
1970, Dr. Robert Moog. It's Moog when I'm talking about him.
He always said, yeah, whatever.
Fair enough. But I believe when he pronounced his own name, it was Moog. Call the instrument, whatever you want.
Yeah.
So, 1970, Dr. Robert Moog unveils the Mini Moog synthesizer, one of the first portable synthesizer keyboards at a price of, at the time, $2,000. The American Federation of Musicians at first opposes the instrument, fearing that it's just by being what it is, would put a horn and string section players out of work.
Yeah. See, what's funny, though, is that, like, everyone talks about the Moog, because everybody knows the Moog, or the Mini Moog, and it's still used today by a bunch of different pop bands and stuff out there. But there was another instrument, though, that predated the Mini Moog that was really, really incredible and could actually mimic a lot of those, like, string sounds and stuff, and that was called the Undulene.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ever get a chance to check out the Undulene, do so. It is kind of an incredible instrument. And it was pioneered by a guy named Jean-Jacques Perret. And one of these days, I've got an album of his of like unreleased songs or like different versions of songs that were released. And I would love to do a review of it. It's just instrumental tracks. Like, yeah. There's no lyrics to it. But I am not kidding when I say that he can make this thing sound like a ton of different instruments. He can also make it sound like animals, and he can do weird stuff with, like, it was an instrument where you could actually add vibrato to your playing of the keys by shaking the keys. You could add vibrato to it. And then it even had like a little like strip underneath the keys that you could hit to kind of like do a slide of the notes. Instead of just hitting the actual keys and then making the notes, you could hit underneath it and it would make a slide noise, like to a different tone. Yeah, like ingenious instrument. So I don't know why I transitioned to that, but you know. Either way, the Mini Moog is still very extremely popular and still used to this day. And you can get your hands on one for a pretty penny still.
It's worth it.
They're not $2,000 anymore. But
go to Amazon, get yourself a Mini Moog.
And yeah, I know you can go out and you can buy yourself like an M Audio keyboard for Mac that'll do pretty much the same thing, but it's not going to do everything, and especially with everything right there in front of you with all the little knobs and switches.
There's a reason that instrument is stuck around.
Yes.
And it, versatility and repeatability.
Yes.
You know what you're going to get every time you plug it in.
Every time. And if you go back, I mean, you can hear that synthesizer practically everywhere in 80s music, in 80s film scores. All over the place.
Yes.
Go back and watch Blade Runner. Like, that's the, everything was made with Moogs at that time. So, moving on up to 1980, clever marketing trick here. Pink Floyd advertises their upcoming world tour to promote their album The Wall with a special billboard on Los Angeles's Sunset Strip that is gradually covered up each day with a brick until the entire wall is built over it. That's pretty smart. I like that. See, that's that out-of-the-box kind of marketing ploy that I like.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's it. That's the only part of that story.
Also on that day, in 1980, the Ants of Adam and the Ants leave to form what would become Bow Wow Wow.
Really?
Yes.
Nice.
So, there you go. See, now, so Adam of Adam and the Ants.
Yes.
Had previously gone to a gentleman by the name of Malcolm McLaren, who is sometimes called the Godfather of Punk, and paid £1,000 to him for some, what's the word, consulting.
Yes.
Yes. And then he stole his band. But it really didn't matter because Bow Wow Wow was terrible, and Adam is still touring.
Nice. That is true. Adam is still touring, so... Let's go ahead and move on up to a couple more decades to 2005. We have country pop singer Lynn Anderson. Yeah, I don't know who she is.
Oh, my God. All right, I'm taking over on this.
Go ahead.
Because this is my story of the weird. All right. So Lynn Anderson is a country singer.
Yes.
You know her from I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. No?
Nope.
You never heard Rose Garden?
No, I didn't hear that.
Oh, it's this really fun, like, 70s country song when everyone else was doing the outlaw country stuff.
Yeah, and that was when that got popular. Yeah,
here came this cat, this really tall blonde named Lynn Anderson, and she sang this song that where she's a young lady who is married to a gentleman for a number of years. And he's upset because his life isn't a picket fence with kids. And she's like, hey, when we got married, you just wanted me. I didn't promise you a rose garden. Okay, I wasn't going to deliver Norman Rockwell America to you. And it was like really punk rock. And she's really crazy too, turns out. So she's had a lot of ups and downs. And in 2005... it was a little bit of a down because she was arrested for stealing a Harry Potter DVD from a supermarket in Taos, New Mexico. Then, when she was caught and an officer arrived, she punched that officer in the stomach and the arresting officer. So she was officially charged with shoplifting, resisting arrest, and assault on the officer. However, the assault was later dropped when she pled guilty to the misdemeanors.
Well, at least she pled guilty.
Mm-hmm. No longer with us, Lynn Anderson. But,
oh, really? She died after that?
Like, well, I'm assuming, I mean, this was, you know, 2005, years ago.
So yeah.
Fairly recently.
Oh, okay.
So, and I miss her. She was a character.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and jump on to the birthdays, though. Starting out with this one of my favorite sort of interesting voices. 1941, Aaron Neville, who is one of the vocalists of the Neville Brothers and had a lovely solo career. Also, the dude was like jacked and his voice did not match his body. But he was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. That's a given considering the Neville Brothers are worshipped down there.
Yeah.
But, you know, he found success, of course, as a solo artist with, you know, songs like Don't Know Much and Tell It Like It Is. Always a good one. But the first one I remember really listening to him on was his version of Amazing Grace on the Neville Brothers Live from Planet Earth album. And he gets on there and they're like, we are blessed. It's like, to have the voice of Brother Aaron Neville. And then he goes up there and he starts singing Amazing Grace. And it's like just classic Aaron Neville with that weird vibrato that he has mm-hmm. and his high falsetto voice.
Yes. Well.
What? It's true. He's got a falsetto voice and he's got that vibrato in his voice that is.
Yes.
Nobody really has that. Nobody sings like that really anymore, especially.
That's true. He has a very high range.
That is true.
For a gentleman.
Yes.
So I would.
But all of his popular songs are high, like falsetto parts.
It's true that he. I have trouble. I have trouble calling him a falsettist.
Have you heard him talk? Because he doesn't sound like that.
No, he doesn't. But his natural singing voice is like a counter alto. Anyway, all right.
Fine. I get it.
He's a falsettist. Okay.
I mean, I've heard him sing lower than that, though.
Yeah.
It's just that all of his popular songs are him singing higher parts.
Fair
but
enough.
He could have sung some of those songs in an octave down, but he didn't. You know.
Mm-hmm. But when he's really doing that vibrato, a lot of it's not falsetto. That's his range, though. Anyway, you know what?
It doesn't matter.
I'm really just picking a bone that doesn't need to be picked.
That is true.
At least not today when my voice is like fading in and out.
Go ahead and do the next one, though.
All right. 1947. Oh, a guy who I have just started getting into his work. Warren Zevon is born in Chicago, Illinois.
Yes. So, remind me again about Warren Zevon.
Well, Warren Zevon is somebody a lot of people like to sleep on, but he's a heck of a lyricist. We played Werewolves of London on
our
Halloween show. His other song that people really like to talk about is the Boom Boom Mancini song.
Yeah.
I think it's called Boom Boom Mancini. It's about the boxer Boom Boom Mancini. But let's see. Lawyers, Guns, and Money is another big one.
Yeah, I'm looking at his Wikipedia page.
Oh, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner.
Mm-hmm.
Ballad about the Great War. Really just... how am I going to define Warren Zevon's music? He was doing blue-collar stories in rock and roll when nobody else was.
Yeah.
He was a country lyricist that made rock and roll in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even a song like Werewolves of London was all about sort of the rich folks who think that they rule everything. That's why they were werewolves, because they weren't people. They were wolves just devouring everything, including the little people. It's like, you know, so yeah. Man, I really need to like dive into his music.
Yeah, because, you know, like, okay, rock and roll in the 50s was kind of bubblegum pop.
Yeah.
And, I'm not going to say, and then, you know. So everyone that was really scandalous got locked up in the late 50s in rock and roll, right? And then rock and roll became bubblegum. And then in the 60s, it became real again and scary. And then in the 70s, they really went away. All the artists went away from the blue collar kind of stories.
Yeah.
And became like Zeppelin's, this weird ethereal bullshit.
Yeah.
In their lyrics. And Pink Floyd kind of sometimes is that too.
Yeah.
But Warren Zevon was the kind of like the boots on the ground rock and roll when nobody else was doing it. And I appreciate him for that.
Yeah, I get it. I understand that. That makes sense. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, he ended up dying later on, what, around 2003?
Yeah.
Yeah. Of cancer. So he was in his 50s when that happened. So unfortunately, yes, Warren Zevon is gone from this world, but he is certainly not forgotten. We are still talking about him to this day.
And we have another Chicago birthday coming.
We got another Chicago birthday. Born just 2 years after that, but getting into a similar genre of music later on after he did his little stint in comedy. And that, of course, is John Belushi, born in Chicago, Illinois. Of course, he was one of the original cast members of Saturday Night Live, where he ends up forming a particular band that you may or may not heard of. Sounds a little something like this.
One, two, three, four. We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody. Everybody.
Everybody needs somebody.
Someone to love,
sweetheart to miss,
sweetheart to kiss,
sugar to kiss,
sugar to kiss.
I need you, you, you. I need you, you, you. I need you, you, you. In the morning,
you, you, you.
When my soul's on fire.
So yeah, I was in danger of playing that whole song. Oh man, now I need to watch the Blues Brothers again. Of course, that's what that was from, the great movie The Blues Brothers, which is in my top five musicals list easily.
Yeah,
just because it's one of those movies that I could honestly watch all the time.
I don't know how it's still on number one. I mean, it's the greatest musical ever made.
Well, I would have to really contemplate my list of musicals. But yes, it's if it's not number one, it's number two. But I don't know what number one would be right now, because it's the only one in my head. So
fair enough.
So there you go. We need to do that episode, actually. We need to do like actual musical ones, because there's a lot of really good ones out there that we could do. So that one being one of my favorites either way, because it's one of the funniest out there, too.
But, you know, hey, like,
it's one of the movies I quote all the time. That's for dang sure.
So, in January 24th, in the 1940s, birthdays have been really good to us.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to point out.
That is true. That's very
like
true.
Three really good birthdays in a row. Anyway.
Let's go ahead and move on to January 25th. And have ourselves a little fun here with, of course, 1909. The opera Elektra by Richard Strauss premieres at the Dresden Hofoper. I have no idea how to say that. Hofoper. Hofoper.
I don't either. I don't either. That's
Hofoper.
Every time I try and say that the name of that venue, the Dresden Hofoper, there is a colloquialism when Hofoper. It comes to that word where they Germans don't pronounce a certain letter.
I'm sure that there's got to be.
Or there's like an extra letter in there, you know?
It's like Hofoper. It's like, well, what about the F? No, we don't say the F.
You don't say the F, yeah. And I've never figured out how to do it.
So here's what I find really bad about this one, though, Jake, and that I took it. I've never listened to Elektra.
Yeah.
Never. I mean, I might have. I don't know. I mean, songs usually, like, once I listen to a song, it's in my head pretty much forever. And so I could have listened to it, but I just don't remember it. So, because I've had songs stuck in my head for years before I finally figured out what they were. What's the one song? Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme of Paganini.
Oh, yeah.
Of which people would be like, oh, well, you know, obviously that's Rachmaninoff's theme, you know, on a theme of Paganini. But the reason why I remembered that one is because of the movie Groundhog Day, where he plays it.
Yes.
And I always liked it. And I was like, wow, that's a great little tune. I wonder what that is. And I had it in my head for years and years and years before finally I was, I'm not kidding. I was watching Groundhog Day with my dad on Groundhog's Day, as he likes to do. And the song comes up and I was like, what is that? And so I like Shazammed it and it came up Rhapsody on a Theme Factory. And I was like, yes, thank you. Thank God I figured it out. Thank you, Shazam. You make my life a lot simpler with trying to find music.
If
you don't have Shazam, I'm not kidding. Yes. You like download that app because there are so many times when you're just listening to something like on the radio, you're walking by or you're in a store or something, and you hear a song, you're like, that's a pretty decent song, and then you look it up. You gotta look it up.
Do you know how many times I have pulled out a pen and written on the back of my hand just a timestamp while listening to KDHX?
Oh yeah.
Just because I'm like, what? I gotta know what that is. And then I have go back and check the website like 3 days later when they finally update what the playlist was. And then have to Google and hope that the artist is Googleable, because with that station, you never know.
That is true. Yeah, that is very true. So yeah, Shazam helps you with that though.
Okay.
And it keeps track of all the things that you Shazammed. So that way if you like were like, oh man, what was that song that I heard a while ago? And you can look back. You're like, oh, you Shazammed this, you know, 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
I have an entire list of songs that I go back and check out, including one recently that I Shazammed on while I was listening to watching the show This Is Us. There was one particular song that they played during that show, and I found out who it was, got the album the next day. So, yeah, it's a great tool for those of us who love to follow the sound.
Yeah.
So
good deal. I like it.
Yep. Always with that one. Let's go ahead and move on. 1971. You want to do this one?
I do.
Go for it.
Because I love me some Grace Slick.
That you do?
I really do.
Yep. You've always been a big fan of hers.
I you know what? And this is exactly why. Because in 1971, Grace Slick and Paul Cantor of Jefferson Airplane welcomed their new baby girl named God.
Of course they did.
Right. Of course, later they changed her name to China, and China Cantor became a VJ on MTV.
Nice.
Also was an actress for a little while, and I only know her because she was a semi-recurring character on School Time.
Oh.
So one of the kids, like, run around semi-girlfriends or something.
Oh, interesting. Anyway. I don't know. I'd have to see her face to...
You would. Remember. You would look at that, and you go, oh, of course. Yeah, that lady.
China Cantor. Cantner.
Grace Slick and Jefferson Airplane back in the 60s.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
there you go.
That's her. Man, Grace Slick looks a little strange now, though.
Well, you know, she kind of
she's
always
gotten older and she cut off her hair, so. But, yeah, no, I remember this girl. Yeah, she popped up on a bunch of different things, so. See, I didn't have VH1 growing up, so I didn't know about that. But, yeah. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the next one. What do we got here? Oh. I don't even need to read this one, but I will just tell you this. It came in 1994, and it sounded a little something like this.
My mind's telling me no. But my body's telling me yes. Baby, I don't want to hurt nobody, but there is something that I must confess to you. I don't see nothing wrong with a little bump and grind.
With a little bump and grind.
Nothing wrong,
baby, baby. Hey,
I don't see nothing wrong
with a little bump and grind.
With a little bump and grind. Hey,
let me hear. See, I know just what you want. And I know just what you
so,
need.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
So we got a second.
Are you happy now, people? Are you happy now?
We got a second chance to play Bump and Grind. We were going to do it last show, and I talked Brian out of it into another song, so we kind of had to do that.
So, yes, but that was, of course, Bump and Grind, which was released January 25th, 1994, and that's got to be one of, like, the best little intros for a song that I remember in that became popular. I just love it. My mind's telling me no, but my body's telling me yes. What I love, though, it goes, my mind's telling me no, and he goes, but my body. I love it. I loved it, man. It's so good. Of course, R. Kelly would go on to get himself into a little bit of trouble, and then would famously be made fun of by many, many, many comedians who had many, many jokes afterwards. But
that song, man, Bump and Grind, it was so everywhere. I mean, I remember walking into grocery stores and that song was playing.
That's just one of those bang songs, though. That's just that's the song you put on.
That's a weird song to buy, you know, fruit to.
True.
Anyway.
Yeah. That is definitely it.
Do you want to give this next one a try, or do you want me to? How good is your Polish?
My Polish is not very good, although I will tell you this. I did just see the movie on Netflix, The Polka King.
Yes.
Starring Jack Black, and I loved it.
Yes.
Jack Black was, like, born to play that character.
What's your favorite polka, Brian?
I don't really have one, but if you're going to put me on the spot, it'd be the Pennsylvania Polka.
I think this... Of course. It's
of course. Now that we've mentioned that one, there's... I mean, we talked about... before Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Groundhog Day also had the Pennsylvania Polka in it.
Then.
And then now Polka King, which had Pennsylvania Polka in it. But yes, if you get a chance to check out the Polka King on Netflix, it is really good and really funny. And then when you actually find out that, like, 90%+ of that movie is completely true, it's honestly, like, the most factually correct true story movie I've ever seen. So,
I mean, the real answer is any song Jan is singing is your favorite. Jan Levon.
So there you go.
Hang on. I'm going to sing the Pennsylvania Polka.
I can find it. You want me to find it?
I have to look up the lyrics because, surprisingly, the Pennsylvania Polka is the most conceited song ever written. Right, so here we go. Bum, 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 bum.
Do you want me to play
bum,
it? I got it right here.
Sure, go ahead. Yeah. I don't know when I have to come in, though.
Well, I mean.
This is so terrible. This is awful podcast. The music, the band has begun.
Dun, 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 dun.
The Pennsylvania Polka.
Pick up your partner and join
Pick up your partner and join in the fun.
Right.
The Pennsylvania Polka.
There you go. It's now number one. The song is referencing its own success in the lyrics. From Pennsylvania. I mean, that's enough.
Obviously, Frankie Yankovic, the famous polka player. So. I dig it, though.
Also, it tries to rhyme Pennsylvania with mania. Doesn't really work. But my favorite polka, just, I mean, for the record, is the Beer Barrel Polka. So.
Okay. I can't recall that one.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Just, we can move on. Because, and I
we
just.
We didn't even talk about what the actual thing was. You didn't even say what the story was.
No, I haven't.
So let's get to the actual story.
Oh, all right. Well, in 1913, Polish composer Witold Lutosławski is born.
Wow. There you go.
In Poland. That was...
Happy birthday.
Yeah, I only put that in because I kind of wanted...
Witold.
I wanted to watch Greg
Witold.
Struggle with saying...
Witold.
Witold.
Witold. Witold. Yeah. Witold Lutosławski.
Actually, I think in Polish, most W's are kind of like a wach.
Yeah.
A Wachhold.
Well, I'm just saying, like, I kept me in, because in The Polka King, he says the name Jan Levon, like, a lot.
Yes. Jan Levon.
So, but it's a W, so.
J.B. Smoove.
Jan Levon.
Perfect for that role.
Oh, yes, he was. He was very good. So is it Jan or Jan?
Whatever.
Yes. Let's go ahead and move on up, though, to one of my favorites, 1938. And I know we brought this up last year as well, but this time we're playing some music, too. And it goes a little something like this. That, of course, is the absolutely beautiful voice of one Etta James, who was born in Jamesetta, who was born Jamesetta Hawkins in Los Angeles, California. Man, I honestly can listen to her sing all day. She's just like Sam Cooke. She's got a certain quality to her voice that is just amazing. So. Happy birthday, Etta James. Just fantastic talent. Love them. But we're going to move on to the next birthday. I got this one too. That's fine. Because it's in the same vein as this. Of course, later on, influenced heavily by Etta James. Born in 1980 is the fabulous Alicia Keys, who was born Alicia Aguello. Something like that. Aguayo?
I don't know. It'd be Aguayo.
Aguayo Cook was her last name, in Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan, New York, otherwise known as the place where Daredevil runs around. So, yes, Alicia Keys became very well known in the 2000s with several great, great hits like I Keep On Falling in Love. And Girl on Fire and New York State of Mind with Jay-Z and like just a bunch of really, really good songs. And she seems to just sort of float around. Like she's not super big into being famous. And so she's like, yeah, I'm going to make this song. I'm going to do the music that I want to do and then go out and tour and have fun. Like that's what she seems like to me. But Alicia, of course, just another phenomenal female singer, just like Etta James. And, happy birthday to both of them.
Yeah, you know, Alicia Keys is one of those artists who seem to, I think having it made in the music industry is doing what you want to do.
Yeah.
And not having a studio pressure you into doing things you don't want to do or work at a pace that you don't want to work at for as long as they want you to. And for whatever reason, she seems to do exactly what she wants to do. And there you go. So good on you.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and move on to January 26th, though. Starting out, you want to do this one, Jake?
Yes.
Go for it.
1977, opening for Bob Seger at a show in Tampa, Florida. Patti Smith falls off the stage, tumbling into an orchestra pit 15 feet below.
Ow.
She suffers a head injury and breaks her back, leaving her in traction for nearly a year. It was like 2 years before she got back up on stage.
Wow. That's crazy.
Those damn orchestra pits, man.
Bob Seger, how dare you? I'm kidding.
You know, I was looking up earlier how many like artists have had taken really bad falls.
Yeah.
From stages like Patti Smith, Harry Nilsson.
Yeah.
Remember Harry Nielsen fell off the stage in a Monty Python show?
Yeah.
And that his hip bothered him to the day he died.
Mm.
He had debilitating arthritis in it at like age 50, you know, from the injury.
Yeah. I still say I missed out on one of the greatest concerts of my life because Dave Grohl walked off a stage and broke his leg.
Yeah. Yeah.
I missed the concert of the Foo Fighters at Wembley Stadium.
You know what, though?
In London.
He finished the show where he fell off the stage, though.
He did. He did go out and play. He did play a few more shows that are a few more songs. Yes, that is true. But I did end up seeing them when they came to St. Louis, and he had his broken leg, and he was in his guitar throne chair thing. So I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, let's go. I'll take the next one. This one actually is I think kind of interesting. 1988, of course, Andrew Lloyd Webber's blockbuster musical, The Phantom of the Opera, debuts on Broadway at the Majestic Theater, 2 years after its successful run on London's West End. Now, here's the thing about this musical, right? This opera. It's not exactly an opera, but it's a musical.
Pseudo-opera.
Yes, yes. So everyone that I know of who is like big into this stuff just worships Andrew Lloyd Webber and Phantom of the Opera. They think that Phantom of the Opera is like one of the greatest things to ever come out and, you know, grace the world of stage and theater, right? I can't stand it.
Really? Really?
Yeah. Really? It's got nothing to do with the music. It's got nothing to do with the music. It's the fact that the original Phantom of the Opera, the story
yes.
of the Phantom of
yes.
the Opera, the Phantom is a sociopath.
Yes.
He is a murderer. He is not somebody who just kidnaps somebody for love. He is messed up in the head, kidnaps a girl, and then kills other people in a maze of death beneath the theater. He is not the hero. He is the villain. And now everybody talks about Phantom of the Opera, and they're like, oh, he's this tragic character who fell in love with her voice and blah, blah. No, he didn't. He's a sociopath, and he did not deserve to be praised. That is my gripe with Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera.
I think stories evolve to placate the needs of the audience of its time.
Women. Of the time.
No, just audiences.
Who wanted that, like, he's so deeply broken character, but he loves her and blah, 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 because that's what they want. They want to fix him. That's the problem. They're in love with him because they want to fix him. He's a sociopath, and he will kill anyone around you.
That's because that was the 19th century fascination with the morose.
That is true. That is true.
Ryan, it was.
I'm just saying, like the original story of the Phantom of the Opera, he is a dark character,
yes.
and he is a vicious character.
He
doesn't personally go and murder somebody, but he sets up death traps that then kill people. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. It's like later on, his feats would be duplicated by Jigsaw, in those movies. Just saying.
Now we know who Jigsaw is.
He's actually the Phantom.
Yeah.
So that's my only gripe. I'm cool with it. Like the music is really good, the especially like the way that he composed everything. I've always liked that. But yeah, it's the fact that he took like this villain and then turned him into a tragic like love interest. It's like, oh come on, dude. It's like I'd rather honestly watch Cats than Phantom of the Opera.
That is
saying something.
No.
No, that is saying
no,
something.
No, you wouldn't.
Because that's like...
No, you wouldn't. I will kidnap you next week, lock you in a basement, and the only two things you will have, not food, not warmth for comfort, the only thing you will have for comfort is Cats and Phantom of the Opera, and
oh,
I guarantee
God.
You Phantom of the Opera will be played.
Okay, but either way, actually this week, this Friday, I'm going to the Fabulous Fox Theater here in St. Louis to see the musical version of School of Rock.
You see what you've done to me? This talking about dark psychopaths.
I'm just saying. Yes. I'm going to see School of Rock this week.
Okay.
This Friday to, you know, at the Fox Theater. And I think that it'll be fascinating. I haven't really done much research into this musical. So I'm going into it pretty fresh. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know much about the, like, what music they're going to play or how it's set up or any of that kind of stuff. I know that it's got a dude who plays Jack Black's character, and then there's a bunch of kids. Other than that, I don't really know anything else about how the musical is set up. So I'm looking forward to seeing this one.
I want Jekyll and Hyde to come back.
That'd be fascinating.
Because I missed it when I was here.
Yeah. There's a bunch of musicals that I would love to go see, but I just don't get the chance to. And I mean, and when I was in New York, not the last time, the previous time, we actually ended up seeing a Broadway musical. We ended up seeing Once, which is based mm-hmm. on the movie Once. And I love that movie. It's one of my all time favorite musicals. And so I loved seeing that one. And so it kind of rekindled my interest in seeing musicals again, because I'd kind of been off them for a while, but I'm looking forward to this Friday, so I think it'll be a good show. But yeah, let's go ahead and move on to 2008, though. You want to do this one?
Absolutely, because there's a reason I put this in here.
Go for it.
Yes, 2008, Rivers Cuomo of Weezer takes part in the Mia Hamm and Nomar Garcia-Parra charity soccer match benefiting the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles and the Mia Hamm Foundation in Carson, California. Nomar Garcia-Parra, one of my favorite first basemen who's not in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, like the guy.
See, I remember Mia Hamm, because she was the one who pulled her shirt off after she scored that goal, right?
Yeah.
Like all those years ago? Yeah, I remember her. And, of course, I mean, I remember Rivers Cuomo, which kind of is even funnier because, I mean, the famous story that he was born with one leg longer than the other or shorter than the other. And after he got famous, after the Blue Album made it big, he got surgery to fix it. Like, you know, and did the whole thing where they, like, broke the bone mm-hmm. and then separate it and, like, all that kind of stuff. And so it's like, you know, because of his fame, he fixed his leg and now he can go out and play in a charity soccer event. So there you go.
But Nomar, real class act.
Yeah?
Yeah, heck of a guy, good baseball player, plagued with injuries his entire career. Really. If it wasn't for that, if he could have played a full 160 games every year,
yeah,
his stats would look much different.
Well, he's not that. He's only 44.
Yeah.
Wow. Played for Boston?
Yeah, he kind of moved around a little bit. But
all the pictures that I found of him are...
Also, Red Sox, I won't hold it against him.
Well, that's what I said, Boston, so...
Yeah. I won't hold it against him.
Well, I mean, we here in St. Louis, we don't really... I don't think we have, like, a huge rivalry with the Red Sox.
No.
We kind of look at their win over us, like, kind of as fate, you know? It's like, okay, we get it, you know?
It was heartbreaking.
Come back, like, you know, three down from the Yankees and knock them out in four, and then you come and knock us out. Like, okay, we accept that. That's under, you know, good on you guys. It's like, but, I mean, if we kept going back and facing them over and over again and losing, then it would cause a rivalry, yeah. But... For the most part, we don't have that one. So that, we've got our own. We've got our Cubs.
Yes.
That we are the rivals to, and then that's about it. You know.
That 2004 Cardinals team was so good.
Yeah, that is true.
Man,
that is true. Even I remember that one. So, but yes, let's go ahead and move on
here
to our
go.
Birthdays.
1908. So. I brought you one member of the quintet.
Yes.
With Django Reinhardt, and we've got a second member in the same week because violinist Stephen Grappelli was born on this day.
Of course, that was from his Tributo to Django Reinhardt. So the tribute to Django Reinhardt. That's talent right there. I love a great violin player like that. Or as my grandpa would have said, he plays the fiddle pretty good.
Although it's probably not a fiddle because I think he's using actual violin.
I don't think you
tuning.
Understand that. To Fair my enough. Grandfather.
It's all fiddle.
A fiddle was a fiddle.
I call fiddle fiddle. So Django Reinhardt and Stefan were part of the Quintet du Hot Club de France, which was the scene that group began
the jazz
scene. Which is French
for the Hot Club of France.
Yeah. Really, yeah, terrible name. I mean, some bad things just don't translate, you know?
Yes, yes.
Like when I was in Costa Rica, the saying like for anything that was cool was...
When we were in Costa Rica.
Oh, okay, excuse
remember
me.
Remember we went together.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, but do you remember the Pura Vida?
Yes.
Pura Vida.
Pure life.
Yeah, it does not translate very well.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true.
But anyway, a true Parisian there, Stefan. Thank you for the music.
Very much so. Thank you very much. Moving on to our last thing and last birthday of the week, we have 1953. Born on this day, Lucinda Williams is born in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Yes, I love Lucinda Williams.
She is a fascinating character. So, would you care to expound?
You know, she has this voice that's like liquid honey.
Man, yeah.
Or liquid honey. It's like honey. I don't know. Why did I say? I was going to say liquid sugar, and then I thought honey sounded more eloquent.
Yeah.
In the middle of that sentence.
Yeah.
You know what? We just need to end the show.
That is true. We're running out of steam a little bit. But yes, Lucinda Williams, of course, you know, well known for Americana and folk rock and some country, alternative country, and some blues in there too. She has been associated with a bunch of other people, including Elvis Costello, and has released numerous albums. I mean, just going on from, let's see, 1979 on up, 2017 had a bunch of them place on different country charts and stuff. Actually, she had an album hit number one in Australia.
There you go.
That's what you do. But yeah, she's always been one of these people who's been rocking around in the background and having herself a grand old time. Here you go. In 2002. She was named America's Best Songwriter by Time Magazine and later ranked number 97 on VH1's 100 Greatest Women of Rock and Roll in 1998. So, yeah, there you
know, go. I didn't even know that she was, like, still touring and playing.
Yeah.
I thought that she had, like, retired to...
Nah, she's 64. She can still keep going.
Well, yeah, I thought that she had just kind of... What's the word I'm looking for? Like, settled down to start a family and disappear. But then all of a sudden she showed up in an NPR Tiny Desk concert.
Yeah.
And it just, I don't know, it got me back into listening to Lucinda Williams.
Well, there you go. Yep. So that's all we got for this week in music history. We hope you have enjoyed the show. Of course, if you want to help us out, remember, like I said in the very beginning, you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com and click on that Amazon banner, or you can go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon and do all that other stuff that I talked about. Of course, we want to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. Thanks, guys. You rock. And by you, I mean we, because I work for you, and therefore you're a we. But still a great company, tons of great programming out there that you can go listen to, and just all in all, good stuff. I have been your host, Brian Kroc. This has been Follow the Sound. Along with me has been Jacob Crumb.
Roll out the barrel, we'll have a barrel of fun. Roll out the barrel, we've got the blues on the run. We're talking about drinking, by the way. It's not just like barrels, it's barrels of beer.
Remember, folks, if you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.